To quote today's guest, Gary Zimmer, biological farmer and worldwide consultant, progress has little to do with speed and a lot more to do with direction. With that in mind, he is the solo guest today for Cultivated Audio September 2022. So grab your earbuds and or a shovel and let's dig in. Gary, when you were getting your master's at the University of Hawaii in dairy nutrition in the early 70s, did you already see the road ahead for you?
Well, my graduate work was actually on methionine, and I was looking so far into the microscope, I forgot to look at the reality of the cow. And we had some problems with effective fiber. In other words, they brought all this pelleted food in from California. So we had to get a fiber source because the cow's butterfat was dropping and their health was falling apart. But I had lots of professors approve what I was doing, and it seemed like I was making a lot of mistakes. And so then I went and fed pineapple byproduct hay. I started getting, because the pineapple industry on Hawaii was huge back in the 70s.
Yes.
And so the pineapple fiber I fed to the cows, and Metal Gold Dairy at that time in Hawaii had a lot of cows. And first the animals started to abort. And then they figured out it was the insecticides they were using on the pineapples was causing abortion. And it was accumulating in the fats of cows. And this was 1971. And so the milk had to be dumped for a while because of the insecticides. And that's when I really started questioning agriculture. What if we're eating pineapple? And they said, yeah, but we're not eating that much. But if your whole diet is this low nutritional kind of food. And so that gave me the start. That's what got me into thinking organic. And then I was teaching at the tech college in Minnesota. That was my first job. I dropped out. I was on a PhD program. I dropped out and decided I was overeducated and undertrained. I wanted to get some practical experience. And so then some of the students were, there was a two-year post-high program of kids going back to the farm. And one of the projects one of the students took on was to put some calcium and some sulfur and some trace minerals on a hay field. And the feed test changed. This is early 70s, and I spent 9 years at the university. Whatever feed the farmer delivered, we tested, and whatever was short, we'd add. And if there was nutrients that were too high, we diluted them down. Like if there was too much protein in the hay, we might add corn silage or something. Well, then I realized, oh, my gosh, what would ideal feed for a dairy cow look like? And so I started in the business. I started looking at other minerals. I started looking at sources of minerals. I started looking at healthy soils, trying to create ideal food for dairy cows. And we had a significant impact on that. And, of course, that goes all the way through to us as humans. We, you know, so I was working on cows, but that was that should be done to all our food. That's kind of what got me started.
Yes, absolutely. And I just have to laugh because I was on Maui in 1971 and we were camping out.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, and we were camping out and we'd go steal a pineapple every now and then from a pineapple field. But everyone told us, don't get the pineapples from the first three rows closest to the road because they put extra pesticides on those and to sort of show the people right if you're stealing their pineapples. But I'm sure it was all highly pesticided at that point. Yeah.
And food today, produced today, hasn't gotten any cleaner. Now we got biotechnology and all the farmers have been using, and it's not blaming the farmers, but they never used to put three doses of fungicides on their corn. And now they do because now we got new diseases. I think the health of the plant and the soils keeps going downhill and they keep adding more and more chemistries to it. So yeah, it hasn't got better since the 70s.
No, well, thank you for being out there and being a great pioneer for us all. You just spoke about key points from the dairy nutrition that speaks to the importance of biological farming, but maybe you could pull one that really shows A to B to C about the importance of biological farming from that dairy nutrition viewpoint.
Yes. And so what, in the beginning, there used to be 32,000 dairy farms in Wisconsin, and now we got six. So we had all these small family farms. And, of course, economics were tight. And so we were teaching them to put a higher forage diet in front of cows, put them back into pastures. And then we started looking at how they rotated. And we started looking at the inputs they were using. I was the first one to kind of introduce in the Midwest, which is on most farms here because we got high magnesium soils, but everywhere, calcium, sulfur, and boron are three major elements, soluble calcium, not lime. We were using a hydrated burnt lime, Well, we were using some gypsum, so I wanted a more soluble calcium, and then I needed sulfur and boron. Sulfur and boron are anions, and they leach, and you're never done with them. So just those three ingredients put on a hay field really affected the health and the quality. We saw less insect pressure. We saw soils improve. We saw less effects on the soil. And then the other thing that farmers were growing tons of feed by using commercial fertilizer. Mostly the trouble was really not the phosphorus they were using. It was the nitrogen and the potassium because they're so easily sucked up into a plant. So we get kind of a bitter, hollow-tasting, full of nitrate kind of plant. And so my graduate work on methionine was really about a sulfur-containing amino acid. That's why I got really keen on what sulfur does to the feed quality. So all these things led together. So these dairy farms, we, like I said, we changed their tillage, we changed their rotation, we changed their sources of minerals, what kinds we're putting in, and we also expanded. It wasn't just nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium anymore. We looked at calcium, sulfur, magnesium, you know, zinc, iron, manganese, copper, boron, and used natural mine materials because there's also all kinds of other minerals, and started feeding kelp to cows.
Yes, I love using the sea minerals. I just think it's so balanced. It's so rich due to its balance of the different types. And could you share a bit about how biology trumps chemistry? I know testing soils can be a great tool, but literally there is more here than meets the eye, right? So does a test result always translate into its bioavailability to create healthy plants?
You know, and absolutely not. And some of the people have really criticized the soil testing. But what it is I can walk in a field. I can look at the soil. I can smell the soil. I can dig in the soil. And I see earthworms and loose crumbly and a nice soil structure. I can tell by walking and looking and digging if it's biologically active or not. But I cannot tell you what the chemistry is. I don't know if it's low in something or high in something. I don't know if the pHs are low or high. I don't know what it needs. So I have to have a soil test. And soil test is really about identifying from an extraction method. It's not an exacting science of what could be high or low. But it does not tell you if the plant can get those nutrients. And what took me a long time, I first started out this business. I started the fertilizer business because I couldn't find the minerals I wanted. I wanted to use more sulfate minerals. I didn't want to use everything that was highly soluble. I wanted to use some natural rock phosphates and minerals. So that's how I got into the fertilizer business. As time went on, I wrote those books that got me all over the planet, and I started recognizing about putting carbon into fertilizer like humates or putting molasses into liquid fertilizers. So we started manufacturing carbon-based fertilizers. So now if we fast forward to where we are today, I started out the business by making compost on farms, but I didn't understand its value. Now we add minerals to that compost. I got to get your minerals in a carbon biological cycle. What I'm in my family farms here in Wisconsin, and we're a fairly large organic farm, and we used to have dairy cows, and now we're cash crop. We have a few head of cattle, not many, but we have a radical farming system. It's 1 year of soil building and 1 year of production. So I take 1 year to build the soils up with minerals and cover crops and compost, and we leave everything to straw. Everything stays out on the land, and we just put a huge amount of carbon back into the soils for a year. So we go, and that's 18 months between tillage passes, and then we till it all down in the soil and grow this massive, beautiful corn crop. Now, yes, we probably are doing some biological damage. Now, we don't plow them. All those things. We got smart about tillage. We shallow incorporate residues, and we run a big ripper to make sure the water soaks in the ground, but not to disturb middle zone, not disturb the earthworm channels, not disturb all the roots that are in the soil. And so then, so anyway, when we grow our corn crop, we put a huge amount of biomass into our soil. So our minerals are now in a carbon biological cycle. They're in the plants, they're in the residues, they're in the earthworms, they're in the soil life, they're in the compost we add. And so we don't use soluble minerals anymore now. I'm not saying that works on every land for everybody, but our soils are so radically changing. And I think what the benefits we're doing to our soils and our crops are absolutely amazing. We've been at this on some fields now for 8 years.
That's an amount of time you can obviously see the shift that's occurring. Right. If you've been doing it for 8 years, has the change between year one and two and the change between years seven and eight, are they drastically different?
I think the first year is its most dramatic. Because you're putting fish from taking off. When we used to have 300 cows we milked with dairy farmers. Not anymore. But we're like another horse statistic. We're out. And then we used to have 600 acres. So we made all kinds of cuttings of hay, and we took all, everything off the field, the bed. We left no complex carbons on the land. Now we take no complex carbons off the land. The straw stays, the hay stays, the clover stays, the compost stays. So we did 180 flip on what we're doing to our soils. Now, our organic matter, when we were dairy farming, everybody kind of was fairly critical because they said, wow, your organic matter only went up 1% in 20 years. And I said, yeah, but at least it didn't go down. Hmm. And then the other thing is we were organic and we were taking everything off. Now, leaving everything, our farm's about 2.5% organic matter. And now it's not uncommon to find our organic matter up over 4.5%. So it's really climbing now, but we're doing a balance between complex carbons like straw and corn stalks and mature plants and young succulent plants. See, as a dairy nutritionist, soils and cows are very similar. I'm self-taught in soils, but they're both biological systems. And the word the dairy farmers use is digestibility. In other words, I got to feed, if I want a cow to give a lot of milk, I got to feed her fairly high digestible feeds. I can't feed her complex headed out grass. That just keeps them alive. That doesn't keep them producing. So we learn to manage the soluble to slow release. And we do the same things in the soils. So I need a bunch of highly digestible, like clover, that's 6-8 inches tall, that we work back in the ground right before we plant corn. Well, that's fertilizer. That's highly soluble. That breaks down. That does not build your soil organic matter. It provides you soluble nutrients. So this whole understanding of the biology, see, and we also understand the physical, and we understand the chemistry. I always say, you see, you can have a perfectly balanced soil, but there's no way that soil test tells you what the crop is like, because if it's just dead soil that you added a bunch of chemistry to, I need more plants, I need more roots, I need more diversity, and I need a period of time where I have built up a lot of materials into the plant. And then this whole thing about summer fallow, I know you probably know Jill Clapperton. She's out west there, and I traveled around Australia with her, and she's into the seeds and cover crops, and a professor lady that's quite knowledgeable. And I traveled with her across Australia, and that comment that stuck with me was major crops are grown after major kill-offs. In other words, that's why the moldboard plow, people could get yields because it killed a lot of stuff in the soil. The worms, the bugs that live on top are now down below. Everything's dying. But when they die, they give up their nutrients for the next crop. But you can't plow, dig, and disc every year. The soils go downhill. But what about we don't plow now? We shallow incorporate and we leave a lot of residues on top. I think you have to put a blanket on the soil. I think we understand biology. I think we understand chemistry really well. And I'm pretty sure we understand tillage really well. My lifetime, either I'm a slow learner or we got that all figured out. And there's a whole bunch of other people are starting to catch on. That, yes, we have to have our minerals balanced, but yes, this biology cycle is what we were kind of missing. And I called my company Midwestern BioAg 40 years ago, and we focused on biological farming. I wanted the farmer to look at the soil biology, not just the soil chemistry. So it takes all of those things to work. And that's why when you start our radical farming system that we do, you got to give it 3 to 5 years. We just rented some new land this year with the Savannah Institutes in our area, which is really about agroforestry and alley farming. It's kind of a fun project. So I work with them, and we rented 100 of their acres, and we're fixing it. And so the first 2 years in transition to organic, we don't take anything off the land. Everything stays. We put on a lot of mineral. We might spend $1,000 an acre remineralizing it. These are conventional farms that are out of balance and dead soils. And we put everything back into the soil, and then we aerate the ground, and we put on more compost. And so 2 years of soil building, and then it's organic. And then our first year of organic farming, we're going to have some of that stuff die off and kill off to give up the nutrients for the crop we're trying to make a living on. But then we go back and give it a year rest.
It's a great point to bring up that it takes a while for organic certification, because in that time, once you decide, well, I've got however, I don't know, is it 36 months or something where the land needs to have no pesticides or chemicals. So you really have all that time to learn and put things into the soil and get things rolling before you're rolling, so to speak.
Yeah. And a lot of them, I'm not picking on the organic farmers, but a lot of them keep right on growing the same crops they were growing when they were conventional, and they just use organic substitutions. I'm not saying it's not cleaner. If someone tried to define organic, it's clean air, clean water, clean food. It doesn't say nutrient-rich food.
Because
that's another story.
Yep, I know. Yeah, well, the word organic, just like they can use natural on a product description on the label, hopefully nobody's falling for that anymore, but labels become dangerous. And even with this whole thing about regenerative agriculture, I feel like, where are people going to get stuck on that name? You know, what's going to hold people up just by thinking, oh, well, it's a system and it's stagnant, so this is how it's done, when actually it's done every day with every observation?
Yes. And, you know, just like regenerative, and I know a lot of those people, and I'm glad they didn't use the word biological and take it nationwide. I like the word regenerative, but you better define what it is. That means fixing something. See, I say we have the most radical regeneration system on land than anybody has ever put forward. Now, most people say, well, I can't afford $1,000 an acre to do this. And I realize it takes a lot of time. There was an old guy years ago. He's had a gardener, and he was at these organic meetings. I always enjoyed him because what he said was, he said, 3 years and you're organic? He said, you're not even in kindergarten yet. He said, get out of high school before you're organic. Spend at least 15 years fixing soil and then call it organic.
Right, right, yes.
Good. That wouldn't have gone very far in the marketing.
No, absolutely not. Yes.
And then how did you fix it? And what did you do for tillage? And what did you do for this mineralization? And what sources did you use? And where were your minerals? Are they just on a soil test? And so, yes, I always say biology out-trumps chemistry, because our farm, I've been accused twice this year by conventional
only
people
twice.
That we must be cheating and putting nitrogen on our corn so the corn's so dark green.
Mm.
And I said, well, we grew over 300 units of nitrogen from our clover in the rest year.
Yes.
So I said, yeah, our crops are, and then that carries over 2 years or 3 years later, and the soil structure, you always start fixing from the top down. That's why we believe in shallow incorporating, but like you said, you know, we've only been on this. Our whole farm is now under the system, but some of them are just starting, and some's been at it, like I said, 8 years. But yes, the soils keep changing, and we got into it because of resilience and climate change. Boy, those droughts and those heavy wet years. See, now we grow 1 year rye soil building and 1 year corn, and those two don't compete against each other for labor. In other words, after corn is harvested, we plant the rye. Then in the springtime, we frost seed clover into it. And then we go to working on corn and taking down the crop that we built up from the year before. And then when the corn is all up and going and on its way, then we go to harvesting the rye and working on the soils and putting the compost on and aerating it before the corn harvest. So we have my son and one other person, because we can't find labor anymore. That's why we're getting out of dairy.
Mm.
Is farming 1,500 acres organically. Now, it's absolutely, and we farm in a 40-mile circle in southwestern Wisconsin, a lot of little fields. You see, because we come up with a very efficient system, and that kind of works for us, and it also gives us resilience and the fact that our soils keep getting better, and we don't have all our eggs in one basket where everything has to be planted in the spring. We give some things that are not touched until summer.
Yes. You know, you've been bringing up the clover and red clover, and I read this diary from this woman in California. Her family were some of the first white people to be in California, and she lived to be over 100. So her diary had a lot of amazing bits of information and things about life in those times. And she said in the spring, when the Indians were out in the fields, when the clover started coming up, she said they were just like the bunny rabbits lying down in the field and just eating up all that red clover. So they were into something. They knew something, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, that's really interesting to that also. See, I'm in southwestern Wisconsin, and I work with Taliesin, the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation. I was on the board for 9 years. We farmed the land. So that 800 acres in Spring Green's all organic, and it's been for 20 years. I'm the guy that certified it.
Hmm.
And so I was working on a book about agriculture, the almighty Lloyd Jones, Frank Lloyd Wright's uncles. So they used to farm a lot of acres in Wyoming Township, where we farm also, and where Taliesin is. And so I went to write this book we're still working on the history of agriculture and the transitions that took place in the last 100 years. And so the almighty Lloyd Joneses in 1916, before agricultural extension existed, they had what they called Farm Institute days. And Mr. Richard Lloyd Jones did a presentation about how he grew 65 bushel corn. And everybody called him a liar. And he said, well, he picked out the biggest, nice ears. It was all open pounding because everybody else was getting 40 bushel corn.
Hmm.
And he had his whole speech in the Spring Green paper, and we got copies of it. Then he said he picked out the nicest, biggest ears, and then he went instead of checking corn. And if you're so young and don't understand what checking is, I can't help you. It's putting corn in hills instead of in rows. So he started putting it in rows like it all grown today, and he said he fertilized it. Well, if you dig in deeper, what he said was he fertilized it because he took a nice red clover crop and worked it down in front of that corn. Mm-hmm. Red clover in 1916 was considered fertilizer.
Yes. What do you look out for? I know you must have had all of your study in dairy nutrition, and obviously their digestive system is quite different than ours, but mm-hmm. what do you hold as key for your own personal health care?
Yes, well, first, of course, we're pretty fanatics on being organic, and we're pretty well 95% of the food that goes into my wife and my family's bodies is organic. We raise our own gardens and our own meat and our own milk. And I'm a real fanatic on this meat and milk thing. See, our dairy is 100% grass-fed. When you start to look at the nutrition and health of the milk and the meat, see, what our food ate, I just has been reading David Montgomery and Phil's book. And what our food ate, but see, I think what's really happening, even the organic world, is now we got mega organic dairy farms. Organic dairy is not that hard to do, especially if you cheat and you don't graze them and you don't raise the young stock organically. And that's what's happening all over. Now, some of those rules are getting fixed. Mm. Grass-fed. 100% grass-fed organic is kind of the Cadillac. And organic value, that's really the only area of the milk consumption that's growing. And there's another company coming in here right now, and we were that when we quit milking cows, we were milking 160 in the end, and we had 100% forages year-round. We pastured a lot in the summertime. We put up feeds for the winter, of course, but it was no grain at all.
Right.
And I think meat the same way. And I think, first of all, I think that's the only way the consumer can really identify, because you don't know if they're not cheating, and there's no standards for that. There's just people, there are standards for organic value and organic, but for the, you can call your meat grass finished, and that's not grass fed, and that's not necessarily 100% true, so you got to be careful. But that's kind of stuff is where nutritional value comes in. So my family also, we take a lot of supplements. I'm a guy that is, I know it's not in the food. We do a lot to get our land remineralized, but I'm still taking supplements, our food supplements, like kelp, like spirulina and chlorella and flax and all these different types of unique foods that take up unique properties. I think our diet, we have a huge diversified diet of supplements. We grow our own blueberries, and then we do a lot of apple juice. And so so that kind of stuff we add into our diet. It's just not, it's a huge diversity of different kinds of unique concentrated foods. Elderberries, we grow elderberries.
Oh, yes, that's beautiful. You know, they're, between your knowledge, your book certainly getting published all over the place, you've traveled the world consulting, and you've been able to see so many different types of areas, which, of course, is different soils. I'm wondering what you've seen. I mean, tropical soil is meant to grow coconuts and these different plants that are tropical, and here you are in Wisconsin, or someone in Nebraska will have different types of soil. Can you speak a little bit to, yes, we want a balance of minerals, but does that change from a tropical area to a Midwestern area? And I would imagine it's kind of miraculous in the way that nature creates what it needs with what it has. And I always think of, you know, there's a neuroplasticity to the brain. If someone has a problem in the brain can make another route in order to function. And that's what biology is, right? That's how nature really thrives.
And you're absolutely right in the fact that the soils are different everywhere. Now, what's the common ground everywhere is we have structure, the physical. We have biology, all the life that lives there. Without that, the soil's not soil. And then we have the minerals. Now, yes, they vary. You go to like Western United States, the potassium levels are naturally real high. They have very not enough rainfall. They might even build up some sulfur. The pHs are really high in the soil. So I actually work, I did quite a bit of work in Idaho and Utah in the past. And I do on some consulting on some farms out there now. But anyway, so if your pHs are really high and your soil is impossible to balance. See, some soils, a medium sand, the loams, and that's what we kind of farm. We got some sand and some clay are the easiest to manage. And that because we, you know, this we get quite a bit of rainfall here in Wisconsin. So I tell people these are easier soils to manage mineral balance in. But out there, that doesn't mean you can't make them work. Like you said, the plants have adopted. But there's also another thing out there. How does the biology flourish when the pHs are 8? See, it has a biological impact, and the mycorrhizae and the mineral uptake and the phosphorus uptake out west isn't the same. So on a farm in southern Utah, they had irrigation, and they started growing real complex levels of 7-8-way cover crop mixes. They had some cattle, and they also did that, but then they grew potatoes. And so, and with all the minerals that we added to the soil, you can't add a mineral to a soil on an 8 pH. It just ties up because there's so much free nutrients, or even in a very acidic soil, it doesn't do any good to add the minerals unless you add them, if they're already tied to something before you add them. So all the minerals that were in that cover crop, all the compost they made on that farm, and then we added phosphorus and calcium and different things to their compost pile, and they actually had a more than a 50% yield increase on potatoes. But see, the soil is not now dependent upon providing those minerals. The biology and the plants and how the minerals were delivered made it so different. So I could take that soil and quite well farm it with improved biology, but I had to look at it in a different way. Now, another one you mentioned is the tropics. Andre Liu from Australia is the international president of Regenerative Agriculture Association thing. I know him quite well. I traveled the world with Andre. I just did a podcast with him a while ago about what is regenerative, because I know him really well because he farms in the tropics of Australia in the Queensland. When I first met him, he wanted to go organic. Well, it rains 9 meters of rain a year in the tropics. So you just don't put fertilizer on the ground and expect it to be there, all that rain. So, and diseases and insects in the tropics are atrocious, the high humidity and things. So he now farms organic vegetables and fruits in the tropics. What it took was not only delivering minerals with carbon, but also he needed all these trace minerals. That land had flushed out a lot of the certain kinds of minerals, so even though it could grow things there, it had problems. Once we got the mineral balance, particularly trace minerals, right, he is now farming organically in those tropics, which is just unheard of in the world.
Beautiful.
You still got chemical, physical, and biological to deal with, and how you deal with it is different from area to area, but those things are still real, and minerals are still real, although the plants can adapt, there's no question about it, but they might not be as nutritious.
Maybe that's the story. I was going to ask you to share a really inspiring story, but get a little bit specific that you've seen, maybe just on one farm or a ranch or with a certain kind of cattle, just shifting into a more biological system. And you just told us about Andre's success, but could you talk maybe more specifically about one thing?
I've worked with about 4,000 farms in my career to get fertilized. I didn't get to know them all personally, but a lot of them were dairy farms. And you see, we can't get away from the fact that some chemistries are going to be used. And I was just like, I'm a real believer in rye. Rye is the plant that's here to save the planet. Now, that's upper Midwest. Down south, rye, you know, because we have our winters up here. And when you get the crops harvested in the fall, you don't have much choice to plant anything but rye. So I've been a real rye thing. We started a group called Rye Revival. And because rye is a very unique health food thing, and it's got some really interesting properties to it. In fact, I think in Denmark, they outlawed antibiotics in hogs. As they feed a certain percent of rye in the diet, the need for antibiotics goes away. There's story after story about the rye. So, but I'm a fanatic on rye. But see, here's the thing. I got a neighbor that's this carbon building and carbon sequestering. No annual plant puts a bigger root mass out than rye. So if you're going to sequester carbon, roots have a lot to do with it. And that's why corn and soybeans don't really sequester carbon, although they might no-till. No-till is just a practice. It's not a farming method. And so all these things that we do, the complex carbons out here, you see the rye is something then that we have to, how do we fit it into a farm operation? So I had a neighbor then that was forced to grow rye because we're in a watershed. He wasn't forced to. The DNR is taking water samples in front of his farm. And no one wants to be caught being the one that's polluting the stream.
Right.
So he started growing rye in rotation. And then I saw him and he said to me, boy, he said, that was an added $40 an acre expense. And I said, what? He said, well, I had to buy the seed, I had to plant it, and I had to spray it with chemicals to kill it. See, that cost me over $40 an acre. And I said, but what about the advantages? Couldn't you cut your chemical use? Did you still use as much nitrogen? Now you should have more resilience. Your soil is starting to get better, isn't it? So I saw him a year later, and I was telling the story, and he said, no. He said, I've really changed. He said, I now understand it. And so that's a fight I'm putting on with this rye out here. Why would conventional farmers are growing rye? Because the government pays them, not because they see the benefits. So I'm trying to get to the benefit side. So I went to a field day out in Iowa, put on by our extension service and our government. And I got to be a little quiet because I'm pretty well known. And I'm maybe too opinionated. I'm not saying that I'm not. But I went out with a farmer. So I had him ask the questions. And the first little question, he said, well, it was all no-till, no-till, no-till. And he said, well, what about the chemicals? Don't they do a biological damage? I mean, Roundup is really an antibiotic and it chelates things. They must do some damage too. If I so just quitting tillage, isn't there a negative to the chemicals? And he said, and what about all the residues that lay on top of the ground because I didn't till? How do they sequester carbon in the soil? And the answer is absolutely right. The chemicals do damage. This is from our University of Iowa. And everything laying on top of the ground is going to oxidize up. I'm a real believer in shallow incorporating and putting a blanket on the ground to protect the soil from raindrops and suns and beating and all those little things. So the farmers out there, the reason we went to the field days, they're really big rye users. And so I asked the question, because you got rye cover crops all over, and I think they're mismanaging it in front of corn. They're letting it get too big in front of corn because then it becomes a complex carbon. I want to take it down when it's young and succulent, and I could still feed it to the cow, and she could give a lot of milk. Hmm. Well, anyway, they were letting the rye get really big, and then they were no-tilling green into it, and then they were spraying. And I said, well, you know, they're still using their chemicals. They're still conventional because we're not going to change that. We can get consumer more interested. But anyway, and so there was still, but I said, well, what happens? Well, he said, we used to use 60 ounces of glyphosates Roundup. Now we're down to 20. I said, And then he talked about management of it. And then he says, and our soils seem to be a better in place, and we're using a whole lot less commercial fertilizer than we were. And he said, we dropped our insecticides this year, and next year we're going to drop the biotechnology. So look at now the advantages. Every acre's got rye on it after harvest. I got a couple of guys like that. So these are pretty interesting kind of things that are happening. I said, now he said, the only thing we haven't reduced is nitrogen. And I said, that's because you're letting growing corn, you're letting the rye get waist high. And it's so it takes, you're always balancing carbon to nitrogen, protein to energy. And so I said, why don't you take it down when it's a foot tall? And then you won't have to add all that nitrogen. So they're going to get there eventually. But so look at all those positive changes that take place on a conventional farm. I get excited about that because I know we can't all do it organic. All land's not suited. All mentality's not suited. And we got rid of most of the farmers, and they all farm 20,000 acres, a lot of them do, and you can't. It's pretty hard to manage it.
Right. Yes, for sure. Yeah, I always feel like I'm unrealistically such a purist, and I had friends that were starting to work with companies to help them reorganize and get with the times, right? These old companies, and they were working with this one chemical company, and in their warehouse, they had X amount of accidents every year. And so when my friends got to the company, there was, okay, well, let's try and get it down to X amount of accidents a year. And so they just moved in and they said, wouldn't it be nice to just have as your goal a zero accidents? And then, you know, why do you want three people or as opposed to 20 getting damaged or hurt? It's certainly a perspective and a drive to go for anyway. What would you suggest to someone who is either wanting to get started as a farmer or someone who has land and they want to transition to a natural system? What comes out of your mouth when you say, first, do this?
Yeah, and I guess we got to look at, and he said, even though I'm really an organic purebred, but I work a lot on the conventional farms, so the people are, the last thing I try to do is get them to switch organic right away, because I said get biological first, get your soils mineralized and healthy, and then start reducing your chemicals. And like I said, I see if half the farmers in this country cut their chemicals in half and added nutritional value to their food, it would be a giant step forward for the planet.
It certainly would.
So that's why I work hard on that aspect. So someone transitioning and starting, I just had that conversation with these first, they get into foliar sprays and again, all these, they spend a lot of money on Band-Aids, and almost like you, if you ate a terrible diet and bought all kinds of supplements and pills and lived on all kinds of drugs. I mean, why don't you spend that money on eating right? Why don't you?
Yes.
We could do the same thing for the soil. So I got to slowly let them make the transition or they go downhill. And the other thing, 40% of the land out here is rented on an annual basis. It's really hard to change that. So we got to figure out ways. So if a person's got control of their land, I just did a farm here the other day, it's only a couple hundred acres, an older guy. but he wants to do it kind of a different system. So we've got to start with a soil test, and we've got to look at what it's going to cost on the mineralization.
Right.
Now, my son is only 44 years old, but he knows exactly where he's going, and he's going to spend whatever necessary to get there as fast as he can. But everybody can't do that, but he farms a lot of land, and he's been very successful at it. So, we took out another 100 acres and going to spend $100,000 before we harvest a single crop off it. Well, you've got to have money to be able to do that. That's only 1/15 of our farm. So I tell the people, look at your rotation, look at your tillage. We'll do a complete evaluation. Start with a soil test. Feed test or plant test is another good piece of evidence because this is detective work. How do I get from where I am? And is there some major constraints or yield limiting factors that I can take a look at? Or some easy things I can do to jump, kind of start my process? And sometimes just changing the rotation, but a lot of times it's minerals involved. A lot of times it's calcium, sulfur, and boron.
Yes.
And then, to get them started, and they got to do a lot of study, and this is not going to be easy. And they got to be committed. The last thing I want to do is get them, I get all excited, and a lot of them chase organic because of dollars, and they get into it. They find out it's not so nice and fancy and easy to do. So.
Right. Well, yes, there's work with everything, I think. To do it well.
Yeah,
and
you
got to
kind of
results.
Work with the whole system and say, what have I got now? What kind of soil do I have? How do I approach that? And I think that's been, of course, my blessing in my career. I've been all over this planet and seen about everything imaginable and for soil types and farming systems and everything else. And I've been very fortunate enough. I'm a pretty good observer to see, oh, my gosh, if they could only do this.
Yes,
that doesn't mean they're going to do it.
Right.
You got to first convince them, and then they got to have the wherewithal to be able to pull it off.
Yeah. Is there an aha moment of your career?
I think, as I mentioned earlier, one of the aha moments is when I started putting different things on the soil and saw the feed test changes. It's like, oh, my gosh.
Right.
What would steel feed for a cow look like? So that's been really the driving bone of my career. And then I think in our farming system, like years when we first started out, we kind of farmed like everybody else. We'd have it into hay for 4 years and then into row crops, corn and something else for 4 years. And so it was hard to manage the nutrients. The first thing, one of my aha moments was the fact that I bought an airway from Australia to aerate the ground so we could put manure on these hay fields because you're taking hay, you're selling all the organic matter and all the minerals off. Growing hay is hard on land. So I wanted to be able to put something back on it again, but on our hills to put manure and compost on top of the soil just washes right off. And so I poked the holes in the ground. And 3 years later, I had it for sale. Someone said, why did you sell it? And I said, because I figured it was something really simple. Why am I leaving it in hay for 4 years? Why not just a seeding year in one or two? And then I'd have a tighter rotation. And you could say, well, I'm not going to be leaving it sit so long. But the longer you leave hay in, the harder it has been on the soil. It just demineralizes and takes all the organic matter off. So tightening that rotation was a kind of an aha moment. I said, I don't have to do what everybody's been doing for 4 years. And they always use the argument that buying the alfalfa seed or grass seed is so expensive. But nowadays, that's no different than buying corn seed. Corn seeds, everything's expensive now.
Yes, absolutely.
So we run this real tight rotation was a real aha moment for me and a lot of other farmers once I got them convinced of how beneficial that could be on chemical use, on having to buy fertilizers or nitrogen, on what it does for your soil health.
Is there an interview question that you wish you would be asked but never are? Is there a point you feel like, wow, no one really thinks of this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I cover a lot of the base. I think in this, probably I talk a little fast, and I understand that. I talk as fast as I think, and then I go over things, and the next time I see that same person or same thing, I get... It's almost like a deer in the headlight look. They're not familiar. They haven't heard of it. They don't grasp it from a concept side.
Wonderful.
They grasp it. They even if they try to memorize the words. And so it seems like I struggle to explain things. I have to go over things. And maybe you do have to hear things for four times before they sink in. So some of my frustrations are that. Why it just seems so obvious to me. And I say, we got it all figured out in my lifetime. But how do I relay that message out here? So I don't know what question would be answered, but that's the question I struggle with mentally all the time. How do I get people to understand this better? Easier?
Yes. Well, I think what we've heard today is just an amazing amount of information, well worth a few listens. And to close, Gary, I saw a video of you one time talking about what you would do as Secretary of Agriculture. And just in case that does not come to pass, what does the A and the B and the C of that look like? if you were.
That's why I said, first, I want the job. I only want it for a day. I need a bodyguard, and anything I say goes.
Right.
That's how it's going to work.
Perfect.
You and I know that ain't going to happen. But anyway, I said, it's really simple to change agriculture. And right now, I tell people, environmental law and policy group on a D.C. lobbying group, I spoke last winter at it was Zoom. I wanted to be there. And they said, what would you do to really change agriculture? And I said, first of all, we got to quit subsidizing corn and soybeans. First, they're tough on the soil. And I said, we got to get a third crop in there. I don't care if it's wheat or rye. Everybody talks about how we're going to feed the world. People don't eat corn and beans. Livestock do eat some, but that's not what it's grown for. So why don't we, if we're going to feed the world, why don't we figure out even rice? I don't care. Let's find something that we can feed to people and improve its nutritional value and put that in rotation. So that third crop I need to subsidize, not corn and soybeans. So that's cover crops. It's going to be my third crop. And so as Secretary of Agriculture, I would put all my focus and dollars on, I'd like to say carbon and I'd like to say soil health, but they're vague terms. I could say, I could look at you and say, you probably look pretty healthy, but are you really healthy? Health is not something that's black and white. It's gray area. So it's hard to measure those things, but that's really what we really want to come out of it. So I can't hardly measure it. So I can look at practices. What kind of tillage are you doing? So I could reward the farmer for practices, like making sure I got my residue shell and make sure I don't have a crust on top of the ground. Make sure I got a diversity of plants. And so these are all soil health definitions.
Yes.
I'd have to come up with some kind of a method that farmers could be subsidized for getting soils healthy and backing down on chemistry. I said, and there's one last thing. I'd subsidize that cover crop or third crop, but I want to tax nitrogen really high. Mm-hmm. And so I got accused because nitrogen prices were skyrocketing after that war. Someone wanted to know if I had an influence on that. I said, no, I wanted to tax it.
Yeah.
I wanted to say, someone asked me, how much tax? I said, well, how much tax did it take to get people to quit smoking?
Right.
Cigarettes, so let's tax nitrogen. And I said, I don't care. Drive it so high. Because nitrogen's the culprit. Nitrogen's the bad guy. Nitrogen's the one that burns carbon. Nitrogen's the one that it interferes with plant health. And so just free nitrogen. So if they got really good at nitrogen use and put carbon with it and got it in the carbon biological cycle or even grew nitrogen, it's the only mineral we can grow. So if I got nitrogen tax, these guys might even consider in their small grain year off to grow clover and then cut. See, our farmers are abundant with nitrogen. Of course, we don't buy any. So everybody doesn't be that extreme. So if I tax nitrogen, I don't care what it would be. So we'd have to get the farmers would have to use half as much as they are or less if they were going to survive economically. We would have radically changed the farm.
Yes.
And the soils and people's health.
Yep. And, you know, one time for my radio show Tributaries, I interviewed a Korean man who had proclaimed he was enlightened. So I felt compelled to ask him what he did when he realized he was enlightened. And he actually had the greatest answer, Gary, which made me believe that he was enlightened. And he said, I started getting up earlier. And from where I sit, you must be getting up very early in order to accomplish everything you do. So, mahalo.
Well, I've been really blessed. And yes, I'm passionate about it. And I don't know how to retire because I'm in the middle of this and I don't want to retire. It's a really exciting time to see some of the changes. And I want to be, just like a lot of farmers want to be a part of the change. They don't want to be the problem. They just don't know how.
Yes.
And that's why they need some guidance. And I'm way beyond retirement. But I guess as long as I'm healthy and keep going, that's not on my cards.
Perfect.
I've been fortunate.
What a powerhouse of information and care for our planet. Gary Zimmer, founder and CEO of Midwestern BioAg. You can find us at cultivatedaudio.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being with us and for helping make Here Where We All Want to Be.